You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where Greedo shot first. I'm your host, Justin Emelsnesky, and if you want to know why I made that comment that would possibly drive Daniel crazy, you should sign up to be a Patreon supporter right now, because this week we are going to be releasing our Patreon-exclusive review of Solo, a Star Wars movie. Not Solo, a red plastic cup movie. Solo, a Star Wars movie. And we discuss Greedo shot first, Han shot first in that review. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, or just outside of it now because he just moved to the suburbs, Daniel T. Richards.
And it was an epic Patreon review, if I say so myself. We just recorded it, and you would get such wonderful insights, such as the Proletarabot, or whatever, L337, and the shallowness of that character, and how we all cheered when the feminist spouting Marxism demanding robot was killed. But really, you know, the one thing I want everyone on this show to know, and you don't need to be a Patreon exclusive subscriber to get this insight, I did not know after The Last Jedi that a Star Wars movie could stoop so low. Thank you.
So low, stooping so low.
That's all. That's my big thing I wanted to say, Justin. I wrote that joke 2 weeks ago, and I needed it to be said.
Yeah, no, it's a good one. It's a good one. Mm-hmm. And other things you'll hear on the episode, you'll hear how I would have rewritten basically the second 2/3 of the movie to make it a much better movie. So sign up for Patreon, you'll get all that. But we have this episode to get to, so let's bring in our other co-host joining us from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman on drugs to forgo his gay white male privilege, William Green.
Hello. Yeah, I had a little minor surgery on Friday. Everything's fine, but I am high on pain medication, so I'm only half responsible for what I say this week. Disclaimer in case I say anything super offensive, but maybe I'll make some bad dad jokes like Daniel and make up for it.
Look, I gotta practice, okay? You people are as close to children as I have right now, so.
Well, we are immature.
I resemble that remark.
So I gotta work on it. Also, being high on drugs and saying offensive things, I think might actually bring the offensive quotient down
for the show. Yeah, so. That's true. But just call me Roseanne. I'm not on Ambien, but if I say anything
very
racist,
appropriate for this week,
I'm gonna blame it on that.
That's right. Did you
see
that?
We'll get to that.
Okay, never mind. We'll talk about it later.
Yeah, we'll get to that when we talk about it, but I was shocked when the Ambien thing came out. I was like, really? That's where you're going with this?
Yeah.
All right, let's get into all that. There's a whole lot of this crap to talk about, not just from Roseanne. We got Samantha Bee as well. We got the right and the left going crazy. It's going to be a good week in the news here. So let's go to the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. Isn't just a fad.
The White House is demanding a response from Time Warner after host Samantha Bee calls Ivanka Trump a feckless. See you next Tuesday. Thank you, Justin, for a week of news that features more words I can't say in this endless endeavor to make me sound like a prude. The White House is demanding a response from Time Warner and TBS after comedian Samantha Bee called President Donald Trump's daughter Ivanka Trump a feckless. Quote, this is from Press Secretary Sarah Sanders in a statement to reporters. Quote, her disgusting comments, i.e. Samantha Bee's, and show are not fit for broadcast, and executives at Time Warner and TBS must demonstrate that such explicit profanity about female members of this administration will not be condoned on its network. Samantha Bee got in trouble by showing a photo of Ivanka and her child and saying, "You know, Ivanka, that's a beautiful photo of you and your child, but let me say one mother to another, do something about your dad's immigration practices, you feckless..." And Sarah Huckabee Sanders also condemned Bee's language and the collective silence from the establishment media. So, Justin, my question to you is, what the hell is the White House doing officially releasing a statement about this and effectively demanding that a private company fire someone over a tasteless remark?
Well, when you start saying this stuff about influencing a private company, that's where we get into the real danger of this story, right?
Yes.
But what they're doing really is they're running Trump's reelection campaign. That's all this is fanning this fire for the next three more years in order to get Trump reelected, to keep this whole media versus Trump narrative going. That's all this 100% is, because look, when you're a public figure, people are going to say fucked up things about you. There's no reason for the government, which is supposed to be focused on running the country, to exert any effort on this. Samantha Bee is a nobody. She has a small show on a small network. She's not funny. She just toes the typical leftist line. There's nothing about her that's remarkable in any way. So the fact that the White House remarked on her career actually makes her more important than she ever was before. Congratulations, Donald Trump. You just made Samantha Bee's career. You made her relevant. She was not relevant before your press secretary went out there and uttered her name. You played right into her game.
Yeah. Also, if you're offended by the fact that, by the way, they didn't say, like, you know, the president's daughter, you know, is off limits or whatever. They said a member of this administration, which makes it all the more totalitarian sounding that you can't criticize a member of the administration. But the point is, if they were genuinely offended and didn't want this, you know, thought this utterance was distasteful, why make a huge media story out of it, such that the remark would be repeated, I don't know, 150,000 times on various media outlets over the past 48 hours, and have Ivanka?
Right, it's the whole thing about not re-traumatizing the victim.
Right. It seems nonsense, like complete, total nonsense. William, again, First Amendment, whatnot, Samantha Bee, idiot. But is this yet another example of conservative snowflakeism?
I think it is. I think it's trying to use the left's tactics against them. And we've seen some cases where this has been a good thing, right? And I agree with Justin. This is kind of a bad thing. This is not what we want someone from the government doing, meddling with the private sector, meddling with the free speech of other folks. But at the same time, this is exactly what Trump's base want. They want to see someone standing up against the double standard that's in the media. And so I think this is going to work. I mean, keeping stuff like this going, all these low rating talk show hosts, late night hosts, are exactly what's going to lead to Trump's reelection.
Yeah, it's
no doubt that that's what his supporters want. And it's no doubt that it's going to work. But that's exactly the problem with his supporters, his administration, and the right wing. They have this whole... there's this weird, each side has their own elitism where they both think they have this highly evolved perspective and they're the ones who should be followed to fix the country. But both sides are just in the weeds and they're just doing the most terrible things and focused on the wrong things, the lowest common denominator things. And this is the thing on the right. They think that this is where they're going to win the culture war. They think that this is where they're going to win the country back, and they're just wasting their times to make themselves feel better. And it's just, this is why the right is completely unsympathetic now. I don't care. And it launched to an extra level in our next story, which we'll talk about, with they had to go out of their way to tear Samantha Bee down and also out of their way to support someone else. And it's just, it makes the right wholly unlikable, where before at least there seemed to be like, oh, well, they're trying to be moral. Now it's just, now you're as elitist and emotionalist and collectivist as the other side, and it's fuck you too. Fuck all of you.
Indeed. And as so we've noted on this show before, that usually when we're, you know, talking about the left and their snowflakeism, it's because someone has presented an idea they don't like, i.e. someone disagrees with them. And the rights, you know, they tend to see it as more sympathetic because it's usually their snowflakeism comes out when someone is mean to them. But honestly, it just makes me see them as more juvenile. I mean, what is the president of the United States or his administration doing getting involved, like you said, with a third-rate, no-name, quasi-funny, not-funny, you know, a propagandist host? What are they doing getting involved when this person says anything? Who cares? The answer to the question when reporters ask, do you have a response to Samantha Bee calling Ivanka Trump a feckless so-and-so? The answer is, who?
Correct.
Don't we have North Korea to be talking about? Shouldn't we be talking about trade policy and, you know, terrorism and literally anything else other than who? I don't even know who you're talking about.
I disagree. Also, I disagree slightly with you, Daniel. And this is something I was kind of saving for the second story, but I'll fire it here. It's mainly a question for Justin, but you can jump in too. I feel like this is a false dichotomy. There's a way to stand up and point out politically, point out this media double standard without it seeming like a totalitarian power grab, right? There's a way of pointing out this this hypocrisy and fighting against this political correctness without calling for the same deplatforming and snowflakeism. And I think that's what the right is missing the opportunity in. They're not standing up for it the right way. So Justin, I was going to ask you, what would be the right response? You know, like, I get Daniel's point that one response is, you know, Samantha who, but there's a way to point out this double standard without calling for everyone to be fired.
Well, I think Samantha who was a show that ran at a point. So that might get confusing if you say that, but you're right, William. As I walk this back, emotionally, the best response is Samantha Who, because it's fucking hilarious, right? Like, that's the ultimate way you could snipe Samantha Bee. It's like, what do they say nowadays? Throwing shade? That's the ultimate shade you could throw at Samantha Bee. But you're right. The best response is to hire Bill Belichick as your press secretary. I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek, but what I mean is, the only response would have been, I'm focused on Kim Jong-un. The administration is focused on the peace talks with North Korea. That's the response. You elevate the discourse and you expose how absurd they are by just pointing out something that matters much, much more. And that's why Belichick does what he does, because he's trying to keep the conversation focused on what matters. You know, they ask him like, you know, why isn't Tom Brady at organized teamed activities? I'm only going to talk about the players who are here. That's how you deal with it. It's a non-essential story. It doesn't mean anything. What matters is coaching the players that are there. So you talk about the players that are there. You're not lying. There's nothing dishonest about it. So that's what you do, William. That is the response, is to keep focusing the conversation directly back to what is important. You know, there's this thing in PR. They teach these players, they teach celebrities to always redirect back to your message, right? They do that with the politicians too, right? Always redirect back to your message. But there's this idea that you have to be subtle with it and you have to be indirect about it. But when the media is no longer being subtle, when your opponents are no longer being subtle, when they're just saying, hey, so-and-so is a cunt, all subtlety has gone out the window. So stop being subtle back. It's a subtle response back to be like, oh, you need to decry, blah, blah, blah. No, don't do that. Act like it doesn't matter, because it doesn't matter.
Here's to maybe give an answer that satisfies both of you. Look, William, there is a place to address the bias. There is a place to talk about how the media treats one side versus the other. But it is not from the pulpit or the pen of the press secretary of the United States of America. She is a spokesman for the White House. What she says can cause international incidents to happen. That is not the place. Using the pulpit of the government, i.e. the pulpit of the exclusive monopoly on the use of force, is not the place. Do it on the campaign trail. Do it through your surrogates. Do it on media. Do it through the Republican Party. Do it through Sean Hannity and all these people out there who are willing to talk to you. But at the White House, and this has been the criticism of this president from day one, why I will never vote for this idiot, why I did not support him when he ran for president, the criticism is he's not a serious candidate. He's not a serious person. He doesn't take the responsibilities of his job with the appropriate level of gravity that the office represents, or at least should represent. Say whatever you will about Obama. He was a horrible person, a horrible thinker. He at least had the gravity of the office down to a T. And that is something Trump lacks in massive amounts.
So, well, and that's why people still love and support Obama, because of that emotional connection of seeing someone who commanded that respect.
And using the office to in any way try to punish your political opponents is the mark of a two-bit dictatorship, is the mark of a banana republic. That is not the point of politics in America. You do not use politics to punish your foes. That
well,
is
Daniel.
That is one step away from being a total S-show of a country.
Daniel,
yes.
Isn't this why there is an advantage to having a Donald Trump Twitter account and a POTUS Twitter account? Stuff like this doesn't belong on the POTUS Twitter account, but it would be well within his rights as a father on his personal Twitter account to say, I wish this media figure would apologize to my daughter for saying these things about her, because I think that's inappropriate and I don't think she is that way.
You don't think she's a feckless member?
Okay, I'm saying that's what he would say. I have no opinion on Ivanka Trump. For the record, I have zero opinion on Ivanka Trump.
She may be. I don't know. Yeah. So let's transition this conversation, which will be a similar conversation, into the next story from Reason.com, which is liberals killed Roseanne, conservatives crushed the NFL protest. Everybody happy now? So the article begins, huge ratings weren't enough to save the rebooted Roseanne, which has been formally canceled by ABC, after star Roseanne Barr described former Obama administration aide Valerie Jarrett as if the Muslim Brotherhood and Planet of the Apes had a baby on Twitter. The article goes on to talk about how Roseanne has said horribly vile things in the past, including that Wall Street bankers should be executed via guillotine. She has flirted with 9/11 trutherism. She claimed the Boston bombing, marathon bombing, was a false flag operation. She doxed George Zimmerman's parents and suggested people should go to their homes unless Zimmerman is arrested for killing Trayvon Martin. This even as late as this March, she falsely accused Parkland survivor and activist David Hogg of making a Nazi salute. And it was this article reminds us, posed as Adolf Hitler for a satirical magazine in 2009, holding a tray of overbaked gingerbread men labeled burnt Jew cookies. So the Valerie Jarrett tweet is sort of the latest in a string of crazy things, and the sort of overall point of this article is this really the era that we want to live in, right? That there is, like, this tipping point where we're sort of, like, all one tweet away from losing our livelihood, losing our jobs, losing everything, and it's on both sides, because both sides now want to hurt each other. It's no longer about political discourse. It's no longer about disagreeing. It's about how can I hurt? How can I actively hurt my opponents? Justin, I don't know, response?
Well, my response is just to build off of what we were talking about last time. And it's just sort of like knowing who Roseanne is and treating her appropriately. Like, everything you just read, did ABC not know who they were getting in bed with when they had this star? When right. They rebooted her show, did they not know she had a history of these type of comments? And then on the other hand, if you're on the right now and you are standing with Roseanne. And I have seen this. I have seen people say, and I've seen tweets about this, we need to support Roseanne because this is unjust with what is happening to her. Are you not paying attention to all of these things she's done in the past? How is dressing up like Hitler and making cookies that are burnt Jew cookies funny? I get it. She's trying to be funny, but I want emphasis on trying. It is literally 0% difference from Samantha Bee. The only difference is she had a successful sitcom in the 90s, which, you know what? I didn't even like that sitcom growing up. It wasn't even good growing up. So here's someone who's been unfunny and now is linking it with terrible humor. I don't even know if I want to call it racist, hateful humor just because it's terrible. Why would you even reference Planet of the Apes? It's just, stop it. Stop it. And stop supporting her. It's, that's
William,
what I have to say.
Is this really the world we want to live in, though? Where we actively take to social media or take to any form of media to punish the people we disagree with? Is that the world that seems like the utopia that was promised to us by the Enlightenment?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Like, I'm trying to put myself in history. Like, you know, there's probably a reason why Mark Twain wrote under a pseudonym, you know? Yeah, and we see this, you know, a lot of fight against anonymity online and people trying to dox people. Like, this isn't something new, I don't think. So I think we're sort of history repeating itself in a way. So I'm not all in a moral panic about it, but it is really strange. Like, we do live in a world where, you know, in my drug-addled state currently, I could say something today or tweet something out later today, and, you know, my life could be over. You know, the way that people are held to account, the memory hole sort of thing that's going on today is definitely a thing. But I also agree with Justin that this is who this entertainer is. And whether you like Roseanne's politics or think she's funny or not, like, some people did. And to me, without defending her, there is something a little sad about self-destructive behavior and it affecting others that I feel a little sympathy with. Maybe the drugs are making me more like Dr. Drew, a little bit more feminized and worried about other people's feelings. But but I worry, you know, like, it's sort of like, wow, like, this person, there's a way to hold someone accountable and holding that person accountable. But do we really want to deplatform everyone we disagree with? Is that really the goal that we always want? I definitely believe that the best disinfectant for bad ideas is sunlight, right? Like, it's engagement. It's engaging with them, not treating them like they're worthwhile at all, like, not sanctioning them, but letting them come out and people engage with them and see that they're wrong. That's the best thing to do.
But this is where I'm going to go ahead and take maybe the far most controversial stance on this story, which is that we now, like, when someone labels something racist, like, that's all we can do is say it's the racist tweet, she went on a racist tirade, whatever. Does anyone think that Roseanne is a racist? Does anyone actually think that Roseanne hates Muslims, hates black people? Do we think this? Aren't there Muslim and black writers on her shows? Aren't there Muslim and black crew members on her shows? Was there not a black child in the show itself who was one of the cast members? Roseanne is not racist. She sent out a tweet that was probably not sensitive, and it was certainly not culturally considered, thinking about the nonsense snowflakeism that we live in. But no one cares anymore if someone actually is something. It's if this comment she made has the quote-unquote veneer of racism, which I don't agree that it does. That's the controversial stance I'm going to take. I don't think it has a veneer of racism. But if we think it does, then it is racist, and she is racist, and therefore she must be completely exiled from respectful society. That is a bridge too far for me. Because anything anyone says at any moment could come off to some idiot as a veneer of racism, or as a veneer of sexism, or as a veneer of bigotry, or as a veneer of anything, because we set up an infinite number of victim groups. And when you have an infinite number of victim groups, that correlates with anything you say could offend one of these marginalized victim groups, and therefore you could be removed from civilized society for it. And I can't abide by that. She made a joke based on, I'm sorry, Valerie Jarrett looking like a character from Planet of the Apes. Sorry, she does. It is objectively true that she does. The Muslim Brotherhood thing, I don't really get. I guess Valerie Jarrett's Muslim. I didn't know that. The point being, it was a stupid joke, but it was a joke, and Roseanne is not a racist, and I will not accept the premise that it was a racist tweet. I won't do it. I can't do it.
Daniel, two things about what you said. The first thing is to back you up. There was that whole episode of her new show called Go Cubs, which was about the Muslims that moved in next door and how they had to learn not to be racist against them just because they were Muslim.
Yeah, I mean, her show confronted these kinds of ideas. No one actually thinks Roseanne is racist.
Right, and that's the second thing is about the conversation we're having right now. Roseanne, this is not the first person this has happened to over the past few weeks. There was that lawyer guy who went on the rant about calling ICE on all of those employees at the restaurant because they were Hispanic employees.
Right.
And people were calling that racist. And no one is having the discussion anymore about what the difference is between racial and racist. To me, racist is when you hate a group of people or think they are inferior based upon their skin color. Not if you observe and say, for instance, that most gun violence is black-on-black crime. Does that become a racist comment because I mentioned race? Nowadays, it seems like we're transforming the definition of racist to mean racial. And that is very, very dangerous because now you're ignoring parts of reality.
Well, it limits the observations one can make by a degree that is unacceptable in a modern civilization. We make inferences about ourselves, about people, about groups all the time based on any number of things, and race is one of them. It just is, because we're designed to think that way. So, and I'm not saying that that doesn't condone racism. Racism is clearly wrong. It's demonstrably wrong in so many ways, but making, inferences about race, making jokes about race, making jokes about culture, inferences about culture, why is this off-limit in a civilized society? I think it is exactly the opposite of a civilized society to put these things off-limits.
Well, we see the hypocrisy here, not that it surprises anyone, connecting back to our first story. We didn't call Samantha Bee a sexist for using the C word, right?
Right.
And that was a sexual joke, but not a sexist joke, right?
Totally. I don't think Samantha Bee's a sexist. I don't think she hates, I don't know, what are the Trumps, Germans? I don't know. I don't think she hates Germans because she name-called Ivanka Trump. It's totally unequivocally absurd that these things are off limits in our society now. That is not progress. It's not progress, as Adam Carolla is wont to say.
Right, and I would say that it's because we're becoming uncivilized, and this is something we'll talk about later in the show, but I think it's because Twitter is kind of uncivilized, and I think that's just the point we're at.
Well, Germaine Greer, famous feminist, thinks it's not all progress in the definition of rape either. She made some headlines this week by giving some remarks, and I believe it was at a book fair, and she said that most rape is just bad sex, not a spectacularly violent crime. To reiterate, these are the words of very famous feminist Germaine Greer, who was the bane of my undergraduate existence, having to read her horrible, crazy writings. But this is how the story starts. Ms. Greer said rape should not be viewed as a spectacularly violent crime, but more as lazy, careless, and insensitive. She suggested things like 200 hours of community service and perhaps an R tattoo on the racist hand, arm, or cheek was an appropriate punishment. The Scarlet R. Miss Greer told an audience at the Hay Literary Festival that rape was widespread and the legal system could not cope because it always comes down to consent, with the victims becoming bits of evidence. She said, quote, "I want to turn the discourse about rape upside down. We are not getting anywhere approaching it down the tunnel of history. Most rapes don't involve any injury whatsoever. We are told it is a sexually violent crime. An expert like Quentin Tarantino will tell us that when you use the word rape, you're talking about violence, a throwing them down. It is one of the most violent crimes in the world. She continues, most rape is just lazy, just careless, insensitive. Every time a man rolls over on his exhausted wife and insists on enjoying his conjugal rights, he is raping her. It will never end up in a court of law. Instead of thinking of rape as a spectacularly violent crime, and some rapes are, think about it as non-consensual. That is bad sex. Sex where there is no communication, no tenderness, no mention of love. Justin, is there something she's getting at? Because to me, she seems just wholly disintegrated, neither here nor there, neither fish nor fowl, and just, she just can't really get a straight thought out. Are you getting that too, or is she getting at something?
Well, she's making a point, and there's an irony to the reaction of the point she's making. And the point she's making is the far left point that basically most sex is rape. And that's what the irony is here, is people are mad about her quote. They yes. take the quote where it says that what is the quote? It's the headline here. I'm looking at it right now. Most rape is just bad sex, not a spectacularly violent crime. Now, decontextualized, that makes it sound like she's saying less rape is actual rape and rape is mainly just sex. So it makes it seem like she's saying there's less rape going on than people think. But she's actually taking an extremely extreme feminist position and saying, no, most sex is rape. So she's opening the definition of rape to be solely about the woman's mental state when the act of sex is going on. So say she's just not that into it. So say even she consents and the woman's just not that into it, even with consenting, this woman would define it as rape. So it's ironic that people are getting mad at this woman where she's actually advancing their agenda. So there's two farcical things in this story. One, the absurd definition of rape this thinker is making. And two, that people are mad at her when she's actually more on their side than they realize.
Yeah. William, some of the criticisms of Germaine Greer, obviously, is that she was trivializing it, that she's too much of a contrarian. But also, this is my favorite criticism of her, it's Trumpian. End quote. Is Germaine Greer crazy? Crazy like Trump or crazy smart?
I think she's definitely crazy. do any of you notice though how close this gets to the Christianity view of sex? Like they've gone all the way around the circle of wrongness and now they're saying, well, it's not sex. Like it's rape. Like do the Venn diagram. Everything is rape except for when there's love, right? So so everything is sex except for that. That is so close to the Christian definition, right? That everything is bad. Everything about sex is bad unless it's procreation. That we've almost come full circle back to the original evil of defining sex and divorcing it from pleasure. So it's interesting that it's almost come full circle. But the other thing that struck me is that, like Justin was saying, she's actually on their side, and I don't think anyone, people are looking at the controversy of it when they're really, think about, I'm going to put my Justin hat on. She must have had some terrible sex, like, for her to think this. Like, I wonder how many times she thinks she's been raped. Every time she's had bad sex, has that been rape?
Yeah, I think she might say it was. Yes. Interesting.
Hey, William, you just sounded like really smart and like rational and cool right there.
Oh, man. It's the drugs.
I thought you sounded like a psychologizing douche. Oh, anyway.
I think, William, the point of it coming full circle and now it's defining just anything that, doesn't have love is rape, that really stuck out to me too, because it's like, well, what if two people consent to a one-night stand where they don't love each other, but they just want to indulge in their lust? Like, you may not want to participate in that. And I mean, you mean general you. People may make that decision, and I would not really participate in that. But that doesn't mean that those people are wrong to do it and it's rape. I mean, even if they are wrong to do it, it doesn't make it rape too. I mean, these are different types of wrongs, right?
Yeah. You can't. Yeah. And you, first of all, there's that you've got two extremes there, but there's a middle ground too. You know, like I've had sex with people that I'm not madly in love with, because part of getting to that point is sexual compatibility, right? Like, it's not like
William just admitted he's a rapist.
According to this definition, but. Now you completely derailed my second thought, but it'll come back to me. I don't remember.
Well, why don't I give you a moment to think about drugs. And give you some of her parting remarks, which to me were slightly more insightful than her definition of rape and somewhat funny. So she said, this is Germaine Greer again, "It's in moments like these I can hear the feminists screaming at me, you're trivializing rape. Well, I'll tell you what. You might want to believe that the penis is a lethal weapon and that all women live in fear of that lethal weapon. Well, that's BS. It's not true. We don't live in terror of the penis. A man can't kill you with his penis." End quote. Although I suspect some men probably could kill you with if they tried hard enough. But point is, I think that to me, this is somewhat more insightful than her definition of rape, which I think is all over the place and not really well thought out. But it's the idea that a man, and she's using the penis as a figure of speech here, which is really funny, that men are not these creatures to be feared, right? They're not. It's an interpersonal hostility to think that all men are just waiting to injure women, to kill women, when I don't think that's the case at all, and it hasn't been the case, at least in the modern era. And so that sort of wave of feminism goes too far, and her critique of it, I think, makes total sense. Any insights on that, Justin?
No, I agree with you completely, and that actually pushes back against William's point that she had to have had a lot of bad sex in her life. Like, this is actually the
Can we get
the
off
best...
the topic of Germaine Greer's sex life? Jeez.
The point I'm just making is this is actually the best thing she said. It has the most subtlety. It's like basically she's saying judge men for who they are. And right. I have to ask a question, though, based upon what she said. There has to have been somebody in the history of mankind who died from choking on a dick, right?
What's the next story? Okay. Jordan Peterson. Here we go. I hope you're done talking about feminism, because I'm moving on now.
Well, you're moving on to a Jordan Peterson story? Do you want to be done talking about feminism?
That form of... Okay, never mind. Hate on Jordan Peterson all you want, but he's tapping into the frustration that feminists shouldn't ignore. Damn it, it's a feminist story. Okay. One of the most controversial... This is an article from the... Could it be the Los Angeles Times? Yes, it's an op-ed by Kathy Young. If you know her, you won't be surprised by this article. But one of the most controversial public intellectuals today is an eccentric, primly dressed professor who writes about esoteric mythology, dispenses old-fashioned wisdom, such as clean your room, and champions embattled ideas of manhood. Dr. Jordan Peterson, best-selling author and YouTube star, has been hailed by some as a messenger of hope for young men, perplexed by cultural upheaval, and denounced by others as a charlatan, preaching patriarchy and fascism. In reality, she continues, Peterson's ideas are a mixed bag, but he is on to something, and I'm no longer quoting, that feminists should take note of, which is that, quote, more than half a century after the modern feminist revolution began in the 1960s, we have yet to figure out new rules of partnership between men and women. And she continues, if feminists don't like Peterson's message, they should offer a better one. So the point of this article, I think, can be summarized in the last paragraph, which is this. For all its successes, contemporary feminism's main message to men is not one of equal partnership. Rather, it's repent, abase yourself, and be an obedient feminist ally. And we still won't trust you. It's no wonder that Peterson has found an eager audience in this climate. If feminists don't like his message, they should offer a better one. So, Justin, this ties a bit into the last story, obviously, but also into an ongoing theme of another hated feminist, Camille Paglia, who's been echoing these sentiments for quite some time. Are modern feminists, not the sort of first wave feminists, but are modern feminists going to take the hint at any point?
No, they'll just call it rape.
It's mind rape.
No, I am, for one, shocked that this article appeared in the Los Angeles Times. If this is appearing in the Los Angeles Times, it gives me more hope that the tide is turning again. Just like we've started to see sort of pushback against this social justice stuff, I think this is another sign that the Los Angeles Times would actually publish this. Then again, it's incredibly shocking to me that Jordan Peterson has become a figure of controversy. Because if you listen to what the man says and you read his writings, now, first of all, I don't like his style of writing. It's very windy and twisty, and he's very indirect, and it's a slog to get through. But he's very measured in what he says, and he goes out of his way to not be offensive. Yet they're still trying to paint him as this alt-right, toxic, masculine person. And that is why that quote you read from the end of the article speaks so strongly and is so important that we hear it, because post-Trump's election, the left succeeded in portraying anyone who disagreed with them as alt-right and anyone who was alt-right as white supremacists. That's the way the left was able to get the messaging. And now the social justice left is doing it again, but with pro-masculine people. Now, anyone who is pro-masculine is part of this manosphere, as they call it. You know, men going their own way, the Red Pill documentary we talked about. And anyone who is part... Go ahead.
The manosphere?
Yeah, you've never heard of this before?
I thought you said mammosphere, so I was really confused.
I guess I don't spend enough time on the dark web. The manosphere?
No, it's not the dark web. So all of these people that, remember the Red Pill documentary by that documentarian, yes. KCJ?
Yes.
They would be considered part, all those men in that and those movements would be considered part of the manosphere.
Okay.
A lot of what Adam Carolla says would be considered part of that. And what they're saying now is, what they're labeling now as, all of those people, is they're trying to link them to this incel culture. Incel, we saw this with the guy in Toronto who ran his van into the people on the side of the road. Elliot Rogers identified as one of them, involuntary celibate. So they're trying to portray anyone who is pro-masculinity as these violent incels who are all rapists and hate women. And they're trying, you know, even the incel people, they're trying to portray all of them that way. And this is where it's going now. And that's exactly why articles about this are written. Jordan Peterson is not a hateful man. People who listen to him and like what he has to say are not hateful people. But there is no line anymore because they need to paint their opponents this way. And this is what's going to happen. I told everyone when the trans thing was going to be the big movement, and it became the big movement. I told everyone what they were going to do about alt-right. Well, they're going to do it now with people who are pro-masculinity. So be ready for that and be ready to fight it, because this is an important battle.
Yeah, it's an interesting observation. William, do you accept the premise, even of this article, and she was partially defending Jordan Peterson, but do you accept the premise that Jordan Peterson is a quote-unquote, what did he say at the top, like a controversial public intellectual?
Well, I think the way he initially gained some notoriety was on this sort of faux controversy, right? Like, if everyone remembers, the reason he first started his first wave of national fame was because he was against forced speech. There was a law passed, well, not even a law, there was a ruling by the Human Rights Commission or whatever in Canada that said that if you didn't use someone's preferred pronouns, that it was a human rights violation, and they were going to compel everyone in colleges to use those preferred pronouns. And he was standing up against that for the principle of free speech. And he had gained a following on YouTube before that for a lot of the things that he's been writing about and researching and lecturing about. And then he goes on that UK television, I think it was UK television, where He was accused of being alt-right and everything but a Nazi and anti-feminist and anti-women and everything else. And don't you believe that people should have a right to not be offended? And all, you know, that whole thing really is what pushed him to the second level. So in a sense, yes, he is a controversial figure, but he's a controversial straw man. There's this idea that the media has built up around him that just won't stick, and they're very confused about it. So I guess false dichotomy. I'm neither going to accept nor reject his controversial status and just say that he's a controversial straw man. There's a bit of truth to the fact that he's controversial. But on this masculinity thing, you know, I noticed just to add evidence to Justin's theory here, just randomly, you know, doing the show prep, looking for news stories. I'm still following around on that Jawbreakers Lost Soul story. And one of the YouTubers that's in the comic book fandom was pointing out that there's these shirts that are becoming semi-popular amongst the clique that's standing up for the existing establishment SJW comic book world, where they're actually wearing T-shirts that says "comic book cuck," and that's really what feminist offers males, the current feminists. You can be a cuck, you could be a beta male, and that's it. Everything else is toxic. And in that way, Jordan Peterson has a point. There's no room left for males to be in touch with their maleness, quote unquote, which is a huge problem. Now, there's a lot of ways that can lead to self-destructive behavior, like we talked about incels. But there's also, you know, I'm not willing to completely throw out the quote unquote toxic masculinity concept either. There's definitely a way which people can be self-destructive by exercising some of the more masculine traits. But if all you offer them is to just cut off their masculinity, cut off that kind of individual strength that guys have, it's not going to get anywhere. And so this is a battle that I'm very interested in as well.
Yeah, William, I want to just make a point about something you said. Jordan Peterson's first wave actually was not the thing in Canada about you legally have to call people by their preferred pronoun. He actually first got big by appearing on the Joe Rogan podcast, and then that's when he gathered his following on social media and YouTube and all that. So he already had a fandom, and that's why it became a big deal that he stood against that, because he already had supporters and they had to decry him. Because it's not a coincidence that Joe Rogan, the guy who got famous playing the blue collar handyman on news radio and then doing Fear Factor and MMA commenting, oh, look at that, a man's man, brought Jordan Peterson onto his show. And then what they've done to Jordan Peterson since is what they love to do. They did it to M. Night. They did it to Zack Snyder. They just call someone controversial, and then that person becomes controversial. And then people go, oh, well, people think he's controversial, so he must be controversial. That's not how someone becomes controversial, but it is in today's world. It's not in reality controversial, but it's people use that label, and then if the label sticks, right, it's the rules for radicals. If you repeat it enough, it becomes true. And that's what they do, and that's what they're trying to do to Jordan Peterson now.
Yeah, that's the only... I'll just second that and say that that's sort of why I reject the premise of you know, that he's a quote-unquote controversial public figure, because the media's decided he's controversial. What's the controversy? You should make your bed, that you shouldn't be forced to say things that you don't agree with, that men should stand up for their values and themselves and be protectors. Like, that's what's controversial. What's controversial is that's controversial. That's the actual objective controversy here. So screw you and your premises, media.
Yeah. And when we're talking about controversial figures doing things that are labeled controversial that aren't actually controversial, I think it's time to go into the Hopeful Romantic with JML.
Written off in the last
quick sort of non-review sort of discussion here because we have bigger news to discuss, but I did see Overboard yesterday. Overboard is the new Anna Faris comedy where she's a working class mother, single mother of three daughters, and she goes to work on this rich guy's yacht. He treats her like crap, and he later falls off the yacht and has amnesia, so she pretends he's her husband in order to get him to do housework and help them create a better life. And of course they fall in love and yay, everything's happy at the end. So typical romantic comedy. But the interesting thing about this movie is at the end of it, at the wedding scene, one of the three daughters is in a suit. And this daughter throughout the movie had been like a football fan and everything. And my girlfriend says to me, she goes, "Why is that girl in a suit? Is she supposed to be like a little lesbian?" And I said to her, "Oh, they're just trying to break down gender roles. Don't worry about it." I'm so desensitized to this stuff now that me, super hypervisual and visual, didn't even notice that till she said it. And there's also something off about the fact that a girl wearing a suit and watching football means she can't be feminine either. It's just our definitions of all of these things are so shallow. But I didn't even realize how deep my comment was about trying to reverse the gender roles until I did research about this movie. Now, I knew it was a remake, but the original movie, the roles are reversed. And what I mean by that is it's starring Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn. And in it, Kurt Russell is a carpenter and goes to do a job for Goldie Hawn. And Goldie Hawn falls off the boat and gets amnesia, and he makes her pretend, or he pretends that she is his wife. So this whole movie was supposed to be about like a gender reversal and like taking it back. But here's the problem. How many people who are seeing this movie actually realize what the original movie was? They don't. So anyone who sees this just goes, okay, it's just a movie about a girl pretending that this rich asshole is her husband. There's no gender empowerment here. Likewise, the rich guy is this Mexican guy. And there it's all about him, you know, working construction with all these Mexican workers and everything. So a lot of the movies in Spanish as well. And I'm sure they're trying to do it to make some movie about, you know, empowering Mexicans and Hispanics, but it doesn't come off that way. It's just, okay, here are a bunch of characters who only speak Spanish. So we're getting to the point now that it's sort of like, you know, it's Pride Month and everyone's like, okay, we need to be prideful. It's like, yeah, gay people exist. Yeah. Great. So we're getting to the point now that these things I don't even think are playing to the common audience anymore, because people just, I don't think most people care about these things. They'd rather be entertained than worry about it. And I found it interesting that I'm sure someone pitched it that way, but it doesn't come across in the movie, because a movie needs to stand on its own. A piece of art needs to stand on its own outside of its cultural context. But the only reason you would know these things about this movie is if you knew the cultural context. And I found that really, really interesting as another example of sort of how Hollywood is up its own ass in regards to all of these ideas. But overall, I mean, it's just a typical movie. There's some funny stuff. There's some not funny stuff. It's pretty paint by the numbers. The relationship he builds with her kids is, it's pretty heartwarming and heart wrenching at times, but nothing special, nothing terrible. It's just a movie.
Is it a movie? Did you say that? Oh, it is,
yeah,
a movie?
Yeah, I said okay. It's just a movie. That's all it is. So do you guys want to talk about stuff that's more important?
Always.
Definitely. Always more important, always more interesting. So I'm not going to do a lot of talking at this moment because everyone's going to know my reaction, especially if you've been on the Midside Twitter account recently. On Vero, Zack Snyder replied to a fan asking what his next movie would be. And he told them it would be The Fountainhead. Of course, the internets went nuts. I wrote an FAQ on themidside.com that you can find everything you need to know about why he's the right person to do this. What are your guys' reactions? Do you have any immediate reactions about this news, about the conversation around the news?
William, why don't you go first?
I was really excited. I really appreciated the fact. If you guys want to go to themidside.com, it's one of the top posts, so check it out. Be sure to check it out. I think Snyder could do a lot of good things with this story. I think that the way he approaches storytelling and the way that he will tell stories visually is perfect for something like The Fountainhead, which involves architecture and a lot of visual elements. I think it's going to be a tough adaptation, like any novel to movie adaptation. There's going to be tough choices that have to be made, but I think that he's the right person to do it.
Agreed. I was absolutely unequivocally thrilled. I have been singing the praises of Zack Snyder for The Fountainhead for a while now, and it's one of the few things that has actually gotten me to respond to negative criticism on social media, which is strange. I don't do this for politics anymore, even. But I think people who are skeptical of Zack Snyder should just do a little more investigation into Snyder himself and his work, specifically the fact that he's talked about the Romantic Manifesto and talked about having an Ayn Rand aesthetic, and clearly Ayn Rand is someone who has influenced him. I don't want to go maybe as far as Justin Wood and say that he is an objectivist, but I will say that he's been influenced by Ayn Rand's philosophy. And I don't look at this even as some objectivists who are saying, for instance, this is about as good as we could get in our current culture. I'm not even that. I call that pessimistic. I'm not pessimistic about this. I think he's an excellent choice to do this film. I think he would be a superb choice in the history of movie making to do this film. Come at me, bro.
I want to be clear, Dan. We've never called him objectivist. We called him objective-ish.
Yes, indeed.
Remember, that was the terminology we used. I think it's unequivocally correct that he uses objectivist ideas in his movies. And that's sort of where my head-scratching insanity has come about in regards to this news. It seems like no one's on his side except us. So on one side, you have the DCEU Snyder fans who are trying to distance themselves from objectivism as much as possible by pointing out all the times of altruism in his movies now. That's what the big move is among them. And then from the objectivist side, and I want to be clear, this is why I wrote the FAQ for both sides of this and for the people who have no idea what the fuck is going on. But from the objectivist side, it seems to be a lot of, you said, pessimism, where people are looking for movies or reasons for this movie to fail. And I just wonder, are you going to be ever happy with a movie based on this book? And is the answer, because it seems like the only answer could be, just don't make the movie. And is that ultimately what people want? Because you sent a quote in our group thread from your on, Brooke, where it seemed like Brooke just wanted the movie not to happen. And he actively wished for it not to happen, where he said, you know, lots of people have tried before and they never came through.
Yeah. And I don't expect Iran or anyone else to be full on optimists. But for the people who don't know Zack Snyder and his work and haven't looked into it as much as we have, I would at least hope that there would just be some more, I don't know, ambivalence isn't the right word, but at least some neutrality to it. Just saying, I don't know. I haven't looked into Zack Snyder, so I don't have an opinion on it, which is a perfectly legitimate opinion to have on the issue. So,
well, and let's be clear, there is some reason to worry. I mean, we saw what happened to Justice League, and you know, we've had to endure the release cuts and wait for the director's cuts to see the actual Snyder vision on his last couple of movies. So it's going to be tough to get something like this out of the Hollywood machine.
I think if there is that a concern, is true. It is about the studio. Yes. Studios
right.
tend to not help.
Right. Especially because it will have to be a longer movie and he has a history of releasing his cuts and being okay with releasing his cuts to home video in order to make this deal. But at the same time, I think there's sort of like a they owe him going on, and it won't be a big budget movie. So I think there's a lot that works in the favor politically. But yes, so politically, there, and I don't mean like Democrat, Republican. I mean like interpersonal politics in the studio. Politically, I think that is the biggest obstacle to things happening for this movie. Not artistically.
Yes. And I don't have specific evidence to back up this. It's not even a claim, it's conjecture. But I just, from what I know about Zack Snyder, I'm not sure he would ultimately have agreed to do this movie if he didn't have more latitude, if he couldn't do it the way he wanted to do it. He probably accepted all those horrible cuts from the theaters on his previous movies, the studios, I mean, on his previous movies, such that he could leverage it into having, you know, what he wants to do on The Fountainhead. That's pure conjecture, but I can't imagine him giving up creative control on something like this to a studio.
I mean, especially after what happened in Justice League, right? I mean, the guy had to have learned his lesson by now, right?
One would hope. So, I am wildly optimistic. I'm super excited about this in general. We've already started fantasy casting the movie.
Yeah, there's a Twitter thread going on right now where people are saying that, and there was a user, I can't remember her name, but she suggested Clint Eastwood as Henry Cameron.
When you told that to me, I was blown away. That's a tremendous casting for that part. But it also wouldn't surprise me if he went with a cast entirely of people we've never heard of for this movie. But
yeah, it could go either or. It could go either or. But I think Clint Eastwood would be ideal for it because there's even the real life parallel of sort of Clint Eastwood is the old curmudgeonly annoyed romanticist, and he would pass that sort of baton to Snyder. So I think there's a good parallel there. But do you have any impressions, either of you, right away of who you would want to be Howard Rourke?
I've given it a lot of thoughts, and I don't have a strong preference. I almost wish it would just be someone I've never heard of, honestly. I'm sure there are many actors who would do very well in the role, but especially in American cinema, we tend to not be able to divorce an actor's other work with the work they're doing in a given film. So, you know, everyone sort of has baggage, even if they don't want it to be there. So honestly, I'm hoping for a no name, but.
Yeah, I'm kind of with Daniel on this. I was thinking a no name British actor, not that they would use, you know, with an American accent, you know, somebody who has really good acting chops that can handle the subtlety of Rourke. And that sort of fierce independence that's going to be necessary to play him. And for some reason, I was just thinking of a British actor, someone who's come up in the British system would be ideal.
Justin, I know you had a thought on this though.
Well, the person I actually realized, and this goes right into our first trailer, is when watching our first trailer and trailer takedown, I was like, wow, Jake Gyllenhaal, I think would actually be pretty good as Howard Rourke. I think he looks the part, and I think his acting style lends to that subtlety. So I don't know. I watched the first trailer and I was kind of like, wow, I think he really fits it. Even the body type, when he's built, he has like the Snyder body type as well. I just really saw it in that first trailer. That was the one redeeming thing from the first trailer.
Well, certainly I wouldn't be upset if someone like Jake Gyllenhaal took on that role. That would add a huge amount of legitimacy to the film, outside of us and other midsiders who are already excited about it. So that would be a big get, but yeah, nothing is going to please a certain sect of objectivists in regards to this film. Best actors, best director, best writers, it doesn't matter because it's not something that was made by Ayn Rand, and that's fine. I honestly don't care if that's what your opinion is of these things. All I ask is that you remain neutral on it and don't actively go out and start bashing Zack Snyder and saying that his movies look too ugly or whatever the hell that means. I've seen that critique so many times. So just stay out of it.
I've heard objectivists call him a nihilist.
A nihilist. Well, that is a very famous, that is a very common objectivist critique of just about everything. So,
yeah.
Nonetheless, just if you don't want to see it, if you don't think it's going to be good, just stay out of it. Don't detract. Don't stop other people from thinking highly of it. Please. Please.
And if you are in the middle, please listen to our arguments about it. Please take the FAQ seriously. Don't go in with this sort of haughty elitism where you assume that you know better. This director, Zack Snyder, he really is someone who, despite what the culture says about him, understands the material. And if you look at the FAQ, I've put together the evidence that he does. And take that seriously rather than just immediately being like, we know best, or no one is capable of doing it. That's my biggest disappointment from all sides. It's just immediately this, everyone thinks this is a bad decision. And to me, it's just, what's the point then? And that's sort of something that's going to continue into our last segment here. That's something I want to talk about in regards to social media and Twitter in specific. And I don't really have time for it anymore. I never participate in Twitter threads anymore that end in a positive note. I will say this. There was one person who, and I thanked him in the Twitter thread. He ended up DMing me because he said, you know, I don't want to talk about objectivist stuff publicly. But we had a real discussion, and we had a real discussion about Platonism versus Aristotelianism in Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman. And I appreciated that because it's like, okay, there are other people who are willing to have these discussions out there. But 99.9% of these discussions have been, no, you're an idiot. You don't know what you're talking about. Zack Snyder sucks. There's no altruism. And if the hair is dyed red, the movie will be terrible. And it's just, what's the point then? What's the point?
Well, we love our Midsiders. We thank you for being able to engage in these conversations for the most part, because I've seen a lot of support from Midsiders who listen to this show on Facebook and Twitter, etc. So keep it up.
Yeah. Motive Power, you're the man. Midsider Mark, love you. Love everyone.
Dan Hackney.
Let's talk.
Midsider
Dan Hackney. Yep. Yeah. Yep. I unfortunately injected myself into one of his Facebook threads. Don't do that, Justin. Stop talking on Facebook.
Well, you can always inject yourself in our Discord channel. Make sure you guys join. You can hang out with other Midsiders and have a conversation, a Twitter-free conversation.
Thank God.
I loved that plug. That plug just put a giant smile on my face. I love that. The drugs have not hampered you, William.
That's right.
All right. Let's cue Dan Hackney's voice here and talk about some movies that are going to come out.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
Wildlife is, I don't even know. I mean, the description of the movie, it says it's about like a marriage falling apart, but the trailer is like the most naturalistic trailer I've ever seen in my entire life. I mean, Daniel, a series of vignettes? This trailer is just a series of vignettes, is it not?
It was indeed. It was so vignette-y and so its own quote-unquote work of quote-unquote art that I honestly just could not tell what was part of the plot of the movie and what was part of the plot of the trailer, which seemed to be totally different. In fact, the voiceover artistry and, you know, the sort of telling of the story, and you don't actually see anyone talking until the very end, was all just created a sense of existential dread. And perhaps that's what they were going for, but holy cow, I've not seen an artsier trailer in a long time.
Yeah, and that's a perfect way to describe it, as a work of art on its own. And it's sort of what I think we're supposed to feel seeing these naturalistic trailers, is we're just supposed to feel that these are works of art and that's what their value is. Their value is simply in existing. Their value is not in telling a good story or anything. It's just something was created to be good art, and therefore we must accept the fact that it's good art, whether we actually evaluate it as good or bad or not. And that was the number one impression I got from this trailer. And because of that, it has to be a tackle.
Tackle.
Yeah, agree. Hard tackle.
Tackle.
This movie was both naturalistic and looked fairly depressing. At one point, it looked like the mother was becoming a prostitute or something, and then the son was going to look like a psychopathic murderer. Yeah, I'm totally out. I'm so bad, I'm going to tackle it again. That's two tackles.
Tackle.
Now I got to find two places to put the sound effect in. You're killing me. William?
There were no abs or explosions. I'm tackling.
Tackle.
We've added abs this week. I see.
The Fountainhead will have both, by the way.
I know. I'm excited for that.
Second trailer.
A Simple Favor seems to be a Tyler Perry movie for white people.
Moving right along to the next film. Nothing else to say about that.
Directed by Paul Feig, the comedy director, it stars Anna Kendrick and Blake Lively, and in it, Blake Lively asks for a simple favor from Anna Kendrick, but then later accuses her of having a secret, and then I don't really know what happens in the rest of it, except it's like, ooh, mystery, intrigue, and I really thought of the Acrimony trailer when I saw this trailer. So, for me, I feel like I'm supposed to like Anna Kendrick, right? As like a short white guy, I feel like I'm the target demographic for her. But I can't. I can't bring myself to like her. And as much as Blake Lively is married to Ryan Reynolds, and I appreciate that, there's nothing to me about this trailer at all. And I think it exposes Paul Feig for how bad he is. Tackle.
Tackle.
Is Roseanne the white Madea?
Yes. Yes, she is.
Tackle.
Tackle.
William?
I think that you're purposely torturing us with this week's trailer takedown. There was nothing interesting other than the graphics, which only confused me because there were knives and high heels and shit like that. I have no idea what's going on. Maybe it's the drugs, but I'm pretty sure there's nothing going on in this trailer. Tackle.
Tackle.
Well, it's not just that I'm trying to torture you, because I'm definitely trying to make people see that, hey, maybe we should appreciate Zack Snyder doing The Fountainhead, because there's a lot of crap. But it's also, we're in a lull right now, where all of the summer movies have been marketed, so there's not really much the theaters are trying to push right now. Because it's like, they just want to get through June and July, and then they can start marketing the fall award season movies. So we're kind of in a lull right now as far as what they're going to push, I think.
Final trailer.
Now, this one, you want to talk about not being able to say a trailer name because I had to take the last one like three times. If you listen to the outtakes at the end there, Midsider Ronnie, you'll get some outtakes. I can't say this one either. How do you say it? Sicario?
Sicario?
Sicario? Sicario, Day of the Soldado. Is the trailer or is the sequel to the movie you never knew existed? I'm asking a serious question here. This is starring Benicio del Toro and Josh Brolin, and Josh Brolin is bank right now. I think that's why they're even pushing this. But did anyone know there was a previous movie about this starring these two? I've never heard of the first one in my life.
I have heard of the first one, although I don't know much about it. I did not know what it was about. I didn't know who was in it, but I have heard of it. I always, in my mind, thought it was the Chris Nolan movie with the story told backwards until we watched Memento for the Nolan notes. So, also, there has never been a more white pronunciation of the movie and subtitle. So, there you go.
Day of the Soldado?
That's not how you said it at first. Day of the Soldado?
Okay, well, I'm glad you don't know what the first one's about, because I don't know what this one's about either. He's gonna start a drug war or something. I really don't know. Just tackle.
Of all of the movies that we have tackled in the past, this might be the one I'm still going to tackle, but ultimately was closest to watching. Because there seemed to be some modicum of a plot here, which is that the president decides that drug cartels shall now be classified as terrorists. Kind of get it. Somewhat interesting, but the acting is so terrible that I can't really do it. So, tackle.
Tackle!
William?
So I looked up the original from 2015, that this is apparently a sequel from, 93% fresh with critics, 85% fresh with audience. So that's why they made the movie. And there are explosions and guns, but I couldn't tell that there was going to be any sort of good plot. This seems like just a cash grab, so I'm going to tackle.
Tackles all around.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. We just triggered the tackle rule. So who wants to go first here? What movie of these three would you watch?
It's easy. This one. The Sicario one. Because it has violence.
Yeah, I'm with Daniel here. I'll take guns. I can live with guns.
I want to be with you guys. And the reason I want to be with you guys, because like you said, it looks like an action movie. It looks like a political thriller. But the color has been drowned out of it. And I'm even just bored watching the trailers. So I think I would be bored throughout. I think I'd rather watch A Simple Favor. Just because I know it's going to be terrible and I can at least make fun of it the whole time. And there'll be a little bit of energy to it.
Ugh. If you're not with us, you're against us.
Man, oh man.
All right, well, that doesn't sound like a healthy way to live life. So why don't we talk about a way we can live life healthier in Life on the Midside. So due to Roseanne and everything that happened this week, there was an interesting article I found on MarketWatch. It says, like Roseanne, all Americans are just one bad tweet away from being fired. And to me, this continues a sort of overarching discussion I've been having on the show. And I thought we could maybe pinpoint this a little bit more and talk about how exactly to fit social media into your life as a positive thing in today's day and age. There's a quote here from the article I want to read. And before I do that, I want to point out that other platforms have other sort of negative things about them. Like if you look at Instagram has largely become a very narcissistic program where people are on their stories. And I think we've talked about this before, Daniel, talking about just their everyday lives and the basic things they do. And this has become sort of what people are interested in on there. And Twitter has become a whole different beast. This article in particular talks about Twitter. And this is the quote that I want to pull out. That does not, however, mean you should share all your opinions on social media. The First Amendment protects free speech, but it may not protect your job if you do or say anything that is contrary to the company's values, even if it's a joke. In employment at will states, employees without a contract can be fired without cause. Now, obviously, I don't disagree with any of that from like a political standpoint, but yeah, the First Amendment doesn't protect you from your private relationships. But that's the question for me here is, what is the line we should be having nowadays? Because to me, it's getting harder and harder not to use like Twitter and Instagram as a purely informational platform. I don't really see a point. It's very difficult in finding a point of interacting with random people anymore because of there's just too much of a danger to possibly saying the wrong thing.
Yeah, so work aside, because I'm on social media all the time for work, in my personal life, I do not use social media to communicate with random people, like you say. And in fact, it is such a foreign concept to me that when you say things like, well, I was in this Twitter thread, I have to think to myself, what is he talking about? Why would you be in a Twitter thread? Because I just don't engage. I don't engage that way in my personal social media use. I use it almost exclusively to share positive news and positive values. And that is it. I will share that I bought a home. I will share that we're having a baby. I will share a video of Will Ferrell and the guy from The Soup, whose name I can't remember, making fun of modern art. I will share things that I consider funny, interesting, heartwarming, etc. But I have stopped almost entirely commenting on politics, commenting on culture, whatever, because the consequences far, far outweigh the reward for me.
William?
Yeah, I think that early on when I joined Twitter, it was about getting news from folks, engaging with people that I wouldn't otherwise get to engage with, whether that's people who are far away or, you know, maybe people who are definitely not in my social circle. And I still try to do that every once in a while. But it's something I worry about. Like there's plenty of things. I know that I hold ideas that are controversial, and that being out of the norm is not something that is tolerated. It's very much a tribalistic groupthink out there on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm almost never on Facebook anymore. I have some, I use a lot of the Twitter feeds for show prep and for keeping up with news in different areas, different things that interest me, keeping in touch with certain people. But yeah, I'm with Daniel. It's become an environment where everyone is out to get everyone, and I limit my access to it because it's not a healthy part of engaging with people. There's way more effective ways to engage with people with my values than Twitter or Facebook.
Are there any explicit principles you guys use to manage your own sort of behavior or content on your personal accounts?
Yeah. Is this opinion worth losing your job over? If answer no, it does not go on social media. The end. In fact, I was joking that I would create a Chrome plugin for Twitter that simply puts up a big banner above someone's tweet that says, reminder, this is public, and save celebrities millions of dollars. But the point is, if I have something that even... doesn't even have to be controversial. If I have something that basically is an opinion, I almost certainly will text it to my friends or Facebook message it to my friends. Justin, for some God known unforsaken reason, wants to use Instagram message. I'll do that with him.
But sometimes there are things on Instagram that I want to make fun of publicly as a comment, but I can't. So there are group threads for that, or I send you a post and say my snarky thing so I don't get in trouble for it.
We had this funny conversation at work the other day where it was like, wouldn't it be great if there was like a unified inbox for all of our social media stuff? And then I think it was a coworker who said, did we just reinvent email? Which I thought was funny. Really stupid joke, but point being, if it's at all an opinion, it is not worth sharing in public. If it is a positive value, like art, comedy, a home, positive life news, then I'll share it on social media because there are people who legitimately use that to keep up with people, almost like a never-ending yearbook, right, that you can just look and see where people are in their lives. So that's how I use social media, period.
Well, I don't think that really even protects us, because people will take things out of context, even things that you send privately, and pull them into the public context and use those against you too. So I don't even think, like, I understand why you're doing that, but I don't even think that protects you in today's climate.
It doesn't universally protect me, certainly. It doesn't universally protect all of us. But seriously, the number of people I am comfortable sending things that are at all opinionated to is fewer than 6 total. And these are people who, if they did take a screenshot and share these things, that would be the least of my worries, because that would be sort of almost emotionally devastating to me that I just so did not know this person that they would do this to me. That's... in some ways worse than losing my job. Although I'm still not really sharing things that would really get me fired, except this podcast in its entirety.
Well, that's another thing. I was going to bring that up too, but before I do that, just to respond to what you're saying, Daniel, you're getting to the point that I was driving at. It's that as much as social media was supposed to revolutionize the way we interact, haven't you just described what it was like having a close group of friends before there was social media? You'd go to work, you'd do your work, and then you'd share your real opinions with your friends when you were spending time at the bar at the end of the day or something?
Yeah, totally.
So as much as we've tried to revolutionize the world, we've just made it so people have this feeling that they have access to the public sphere, but they don't really. There's like this fake public sphere of people who think they're important, and then we just worry about like what Roseanne and Trump and the Samantha Bees are saying. And then if you piss someone off enough and you get enough notoriety, people can use it against you. Otherwise, we're not all really engaged in that. It's sort of just like a waste of time. And in regards to the podcast, I don't think people have enough time or they want to expend their energy to go through something like this. The reason social media, I think, is used against people is because of how quick and easy it is to look at their content. A tweet is very easy. An Instagram post is very easy. Whereas going through a podcast, unless you're someone that people legitimately find culturally dangerous, like Milo Yiannopoulos back in the day, they went through that podcast on him. I don't think people would go through something like this. It's too much effort to click and listen and think and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, perhaps. And then I'll lose my job someday and we'll find out that thesis was wrong. But
yeah.
Look, social media.
That's the principle I'm operating under.
Social media, I'm not 100% down on social media. I think it has done an interesting thing to communication, and it's certainly made brands more accessible than they ever were in history, which is interesting. But it did come with a lot of consequences that I don't think we've fully comprehended yet, and I don't think we've fully integrated into our lives yet, but one of the consequences we're seeing, and whether or not this is the world we want to live in, we don't know yet, but the consequence is it's made communication more dangerous. Which is not something one would have expected. At least I didn't expect that to happen. It was certainly a possibility, but the fact that communication is more dangerous is a net negative. Does it make up for all the other good things that social media has done? I think that is yet to be seen, but it would not be an irrational answer from someone like you, Justin, to say no. It does not make up for all the positive things social media has done, and thus we shouldn't engage, or I don't want to engage in social media or whatever it is. So,
why are you throwing that to me out of curiosity? Since this is a more personal segment, like Life on the Midside, why did you say someone like me could say that? I feel like you have a specific reason for that.
Well, the specific reason is only that you tend to be the biggest critic of social media on this show. And you've said on numerous occasions, you're not entirely sure there is a value to it. So,
Oh, yeah, certainly. And I was wondering if that's the direction you were going to go in. I think that largely, and I speak from personal experience here, right? Because I'm someone who I was disconnected from my family in high school, and I went to a small high school and didn't have a lot of friends. So, you know, besides work and sports, like a primary means of interaction for me socially was AOL chat rooms back in the day. So I've seen this culture evolve over many different mediums and platforms. And I think as I've become a healthier person and I've gained self-esteem and I've gone through therapy and I've gained good friends and a strong relationship, I think that what I notice is the people who are primarily on social media participating in the discussions, besides, you know, like you said, Daniel, with your brands, you're pushing information, besides those type of people, I think the people who are participating in most are people who have a loneliness in their life and they're looking to be heard and seen. And that creates a problem because then they act in attention-seeking ways and you also get toxicity. You get a toxic perspective from them because they have a negative view, an interpersonal hostility view.
Have a day.
So even, for instance, we talk about like objectivists and the Fountainhead and Zack Snyder is the ones on social media saying things are probably not the ones who are more likely to be positive and want him to do well and think he can do well because they're not going to feel a need to go online and do it.
Yeah, that's interesting. It is, you know, every time we release content at work, it is basically the proof of the online, I don't even know if it's a theory anymore, the online truth that people who want to have commentary on that thing are going to be negative, and people who support that thing are not going to engage, but they're going to do things like retweet, share, spread it. So they'll spread it. But whenever you see commentary, whenever you see discussion, it's going to be almost always negative because that is what, for whatever reason, it is negativity drives commentary. I guess it's because we're in an era where criticism is far easier to do than constructing a positive philosophy or a positive note or a positive anything, a positive outlook, period.
Well, and also, when you comment something positive, you immediately get a bunch of negative pushback. Whereas if you comment something negative, you'll get a lot of retweets and likes. So why would you bother if all you're going to get is the pushback?
Yeah, true.
William, do you have anything to add before we sum up the segment? Any personal experiences of that nature or anything?
Nothing really leaps into my mind. I know that one thing I would just kind of close on is I do occasionally just say the simple no. And what I mean by that is if someone who's following me or I'm following says something just so wrong, I will just say, hey, I don't think this is right, and just leave things at that and not necessarily even give my opinion other than just to say, hey, this is not right.
I've done that a few times.
Yeah, I do the waving emoji now.
Yeah.
Where like if someone is trying to talk to me and then I'm getting negative pushback from them, like for instance it happened earlier today, I just replied, you disagree for the sake of disagreeing, and then I give the wave emoji, and then I'm just done engaging, so they know, whether they're able to process that or not, why I stopped engaging. And you know, of course, that specific person then disagreed with me and was like, no, I don't disagree just to disagree, you're just saying wrong things. And it's like, well, you proved my point. And I could continue to interact, but it's easier just to do the wave emoji. What I'm wondering from you, William, is how does Discord fit into all this?
I'm not sure what you're asking, but the reason why we have our Discord is so that we can engage with our fans and have conversations. And it's more curated, so we can kick people out of the conversation if we get too many trolls. But it's a way for us to have a place where people can bring in show ideas for stories or segments, or share something about the podcast, give us feedback. So it's a little more community based, which you can kind of do that on Twitter, but it's more public, right? So if people are in the Discord, it is public in the sense of that anyone can join, but we can limit who can participate in the conversation. So that makes it a little more curated and a little more personal.
Right. So it's a little more private and a little more trusted. Now, there's still the issue of people could take your content on there and share it elsewise, right?
Right.
But does that happen often with Discord?
It can happen. I mean, but there's nothing, it's a lot less likely in two senses. The first one is someone has to be in the channel, and there's, you know, it's not like we have a million people in the channel. And the other thing is, you know, you can choose your identity when you join. So, so your Discord ID is yours. So it is a little bit, I'd call it semi-anonymous, right? So if you're, want to have some open discussions, you can, but it's some step below Twitter in the everything is public and everyone knows who you are sense.
And how do they find our Discord channel?
Well, you can click the link on Facebook to get into our Discord channel. You can see it on themidside.com and on our Patreon. There's a link on our Patreon. And if you're a Patreon member and you've linked to your Discord ID, then you get some special channels that no one else can see.
Because we're elitist like that.
I have one final question for maybe both of you can answer this. It's more of a technology-based question. So we know there's a problem now with Instagram and Twitter and screenshotting these platforms and then using these screenshots against people. But when I watch Hulu now or Netflix and I try to screenshot the content, my screen is just a black screenshot. Is there a way that these other programs could write their app so that screenshotting was also not possible? Or is that something that Apple did as a relation to these programs? Does it happen on Android?
Man, I don't know the answer to that question. William, do you have any insight here as a computer guy?
Yeah, so that does have to do with copy protection, but not to go all hacker on you, but you can just use someone else's phone to take a picture of the phone as well. So there's really no point to that sort of stuff. But there's no point to doing that for Hulu. They're just doing it to make it inconvenient so people can't take screenshots. But even with Snapchat, like, for example, if they blocked you, your ability to take screenshots, you could just take another phone and take a picture of that phone and you would get the same thing. So,
yeah, and I guess you can sign into Twitter or Instagram online on the internet, right? I do think, though, that it makes you look worse rhetorically if you go out of your way to take a picture with another phone of a phone rather than just you're lazy and take a screenshot. So there's that as well. But point well taken. It was an interesting thought. I thought that was an interesting discussion. You can share your experiences through social media with us. No, just hit us up however you want. If you want to DM, that's fine. You know, we're always here if you want to share some of what you want. Or come into the Discord channel and have some discussions about that. Maybe some of you Midsiders who have already used Discord with us and already started a conversation, share in there what you have to say with your experiences with social media. That brings us to the end of the episode. What did we learn this trip? Daniel?
I learned who Samantha Bee is.
Gonna keep hitting that joke.
I'm hilarious.
William?
I learned how best to use social media and how to respond to people who don't like Zack Snyder's taking over the Fountainhead.
Justin, what did you learn?
I learned a couple good principles. You guys had never explicitly told me your principles before about how to deal with social media, and I am going to integrate those better, even though it's a little tougher when you're trying to manage like a sort of brand with Welcome to the Midside. I'm definitely going to do that on Twitter from now on.
Well, good. I hope you learned something this week, audience. Justin already shilled for a few things, so I'll keep it short this week and say go to themidside.com/store to pick up a t-shirt. Helps us spread the word and helps us keep the lights on. You can also go to iTunes and Google Play and give us a 5-star review. That's all the stars, in case you're wondering. You can't give us a 6-star review, though. You can write in the comment that you would like to give us a 6-star review. We wouldn't mind that. And then Patreon.com, that was brought up a couple times in the show. If you don't know what Patreon is, you should check it out. Patreon's a platform for content creators that allows you to sign up and give us a few bucks every time we produce a piece of content so that we can continue to make better and better content. Helps us buy equipment, or if we ever do it advertising, helps us run promotions, helps us pay for like web hosting and things like that. Helps us generally keep our lights on. So we dearly appreciate our Patreon supporters, and as Justin mentioned at the top of the show, Patreon supporters this week are going to get an exclusive review of the movie Solo, A Star Wars Story. So be sure to check that out. But if you don't have the funds to support us on Patreon, no problem. You do have a mouth, and that mouth can tell people about the show. Tell a friend. Write them a letter if you have to. If you have, if you've had like surgery on your jaw or something, I have no idea what's going on in your life, but get well soon. In the meantime, pen a letter to a friend, let them know about the Midside, and that's how we grow the show. That's how we change the world. That's how we get Zack Snyder to notice us on Twitter or Vero.
More likely Vero.
So yeah, thanks Midsiders, and until next week, we love you a lot.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm your host, Justin Elmanzeski, reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
A simple fail, blah, blah, blah. One more time. I was going to call it a simple failure by accident. A simple favor. God damn it.
Which one of you is on the drugs?
It's these braces, man. All right.
Shut up, Stan.